I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Arison Lex Medrovich, an award-winning multidisciplinary artist whose work has been exhibited at New York's Museum of Modern Art and who's collaborated with iconic brands and individuals like Kenzo, Nike, Kanye West, and many others. We talk all about finding your creative identity. I think you're going to love this one. Now, let's get to the episode. Lex, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It's truly not at all. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for making time. I'm glad we finally get to catch up.
Yeah, absolutely. So you and I met via our mutual friend, Mike Del Ponte, who was a former guest here on The Unmistakable Creative as well. And he sent me a whole list of people, and your story really stood out to me. So rather than me giving away, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, your story, your journey, and how that has led you to everything that you're up to in the world today?
I'll do that as concisely as possible. My name is Arison Lex Medrovich. I'm an artist based here in New York, originally from Buenos Aires, Argentina. I moved to the States when I was a kid with my family down to South Florida, Miami area. I've been here in New York for a number of years. I went to school at Pratt and studied there, and spent some time living in Japan. But I work across a couple different genres. Artist is sort of like an umbrella moniker, I would suppose. But, I've been able to, and fortunate enough to kind of ply my craft across fashion and music, which are two big loves of mine as well, kind of dabbling with technology and sort of the intersection of art and tech, which is something I'm tremendously interested in. And it's a blessing to kind of be able to do something that you love. It's not without its headaches and heartaches at time, but I'm really fortunate to kind of be able to do what I do.
Well, you having heard some of my interviews probably know that what I want to look at really is the formative experiences of your life that ultimately kind of sent you down this trajectory and down this path, like growing up, people, influences, experiences that made you make the choices that you did.
Right. I think it's interesting. As an artist, it's, for some people, I think it can be sort of a professional pursuit. For others, it's very much a calling, which I believe that's a word you've used quite a bit. And it's something that I just recently had been writing about where, I think to pursue this idea of being a creative, being a professional creative, being an artist, it's a risky endeavor. It's risky business, for sure. And it's definitely not without its downfalls and sort of like real problems that come up and arise. Success isn't promised even with hard work and talent. But this idea of calling, for me as a kid, I just grew up like with a box of crayons and, just always kind of drawing different things around me. And, I come from a very humble background. I'm a first-generation immigrant. I immigrated to this country from Latin America, from Argentina. My parents are working-class folks. And, I'm fortunate that my father sort of was a hobby artist himself. He really spent a lot of time just like doodling and sketching. And I think he saw that in me. And he came from a very sort of impoverished background in Latin America and South America, and really never went to school or anything, and just had to kind of work his way to make his way to this country and provide for his family for me. And but he saw something and I think allowed me to pursue it. And from an early age, when I got to the States, I went to public school and private school for a Catholic school. I grew up Catholic as well. As a good Argentine Latino would, seeing as the Pope is also from Argentina at this point in time. He was supportive, and I would, instead of going to like a traditional summer camp as a kid or something, like I got to go to like an art camp where there's this little place in Florida, a Creole Day art camp, to where that you could send your kid like on the off hours to kind of send them away for a few hours in the summer. And I would go and take a few different courses from everything from like pottery and painting and like just all kinds of kind of arts and crafts projects, and as well as calligraphy at that point. That's a place a little bit later on, a few years later down the road. That's a place where I sort of first met that aspect, which has become kind of core and central to a lot of my process and kind of conceptually in my work as well, this idea of language, which for me, kind of coming from a multicultural background, that's something that's very interesting and conceptually engaging for me. So, you know, I was fortunate to come from this nurturing background, albeit humble and, you know, not having much to work with, but like, you know, at least that creativity was there. That was something that allowed me to, I think, find an identity. And that was, you know, it's been something that's I've carried with me all along, this idea that without art, I wouldn't really know who I am. I think I can't sort of define my own definition of who Lex is without this idea that there's some sort of aspect of creativity to it.
Hmm. You think everybody has a calling?
100%, yeah. Sorry, just one second. But yeah, so, you know, that's I think something that that definitely was formative for me. I think that experience of being able to just have that support with sort of a very sort of heavy tinge of reality always put towards it in terms of just, you know, the background and how my parents and their worldview is very much different than mine, just because of the, you know, I think the experiences afforded to them are much different than mine growing up here in sort of a modern country. With a much more sort of global outlook. I think for them, you know, maybe been to a handful of countries. I've been to many, many more, and have been really fortunate to kind of carry on. Or, you know, it always gives me sort of, I think, great, just an honor to kind of be a worldview for them, for my mom and dad, to where like I can tell them, and you know, they'll come over to my place and like, they'll be like, hijo, like, yo, what, like, can we see your pictures from like your travels? And I'll show them and like talk to them about what I'm working on. And it's great to have that kind of closeness. And, you know, they've not always understood the projects and stuff that I'm working on. Like, I can tell them, hey, I just did this project for Kanye West. And they're like, who's Kanye West? And I'm like, it's something that keeps you very grounded, because you're like, you can be working with these people and like they, you know, like, your folks, the people that matter the most, they might not know about it, but like at the same time, it's like it definitely puts things in perspective.
Hmm. Well, if everybody has a calling, why do you think that so many people ignore it or avoid it?
You know, I think there's a few different reasons, I see them as being very valid. I think environment and just sort of this level of emotional support, which I think is key. You know, we do live in a sense, there's been a lot of articles written about kind of this idea of we're living in sort of the generation of exceptionalism, where I think kids growing up are taught that they can do anything and be anything. And while that has its merits, I think it's also dangerous, because I think without qualification, it might empower somebody I wouldn't say empower is the right word, but it might sort of, I guess, set somebody off on the trajectory to where it's like, well, you know, I'm deserving of whatever I wish to make happen or have happened for my life. But that's not always the case. And I think when people first taste those inklings of failure, or when hardships kind of arise, those are things that are off-putting to folks that are kind of brought up to think that, like, well, anything is possible. And there are, you know, it's, you know, every road to success is paved with, like, you know, bricks of failures. And that's something that rings so true. And I think for those that do have a calling, I think, I don't know, there might be an aversion to really embracing the hardship that path might present, or that it might sort of bring forth. And, you know, I think it really kind of depends on one's background. And, you know, for me, I think about this every day, to where I was just reading this article on Quartz about sort of there's not really a gene for entrepreneurship. I think we exist in a society where entrepreneurship is lauded And it's something that is, I wouldn't say deified, but definitely celebrated to an extent, but without really knowing, I think, the backgrounds and the kind of the, let's say, the trajectories of the persons that are actually succeeding. A lot of these folks have come from, not affluence, but let's say they'll come from a place to where they'll have like a security or like a safety net to where if they risk everything, like they're still not going to be out on the street. But like, you know, for me and for my family, like one misstep could mean, you know, like a very different sort of lifestyle very quickly. And that's something that's always been very sobering. And it's something that's, I think, driven me to try and work that much harder and also just try to be a better person because, you know, I feel that, as Mike Del Ponte had said, you know, I think it is about kind of maintaining this humility about what you're doing, and being sincere about that pursuit where, you know, I think, in one of your previous shows, you were talking about, you know, calling and, you know, for some that calling or what they wish their trajectory would be to go out and make a bunch of money. And, I mean, for me, I think that's important as well. It's important to be able to provide for the people in your life. And for me, I'd love to be able to provide for my family and the family that I wish to have. And, art is one of the hardest ways to do that. I think it's the illogical decision in many senses where, you know, this, as you had mentioned before, a linear path is something that I think is more quote unquote guaranteed. And I can't tell you, like, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have my work shown at the MoMA and, you know, winning prizes and being awarded as one of the top 40 alumni from Pratt, like a top design school, art school in the country. And to this day, my parents are like, hijo, like, you know, if it doesn't go well for you, like, you can always come home and, like, go get your business degree. Like, they're always like, you know, you should just take a business class at night. You know, just, you're never too late. And it's, again, humbling, and it's that generation's viewpoint of how things work, and that's completely valid. I think it has a place in our world today, even though that we talk about that everybody is their own personal brand and that, like, social media is empowering everybody to kind of be their own entrepreneur and, like, sort of shape and sort of image the life that they wish to be and sort of live. But that's a dangerous thing because I think once you go down that route, it only serves to put focus on those that can bring real substantive value and real, I think, a real sort of clear and concise and focused language and communication to whatever it is they're trying to do, whether it would be business, whether it would be art, whether it would be performing and music, whether it would be sort of humanitarian work. You know, I think the idea that anybody can do anything, it's a dangerous thought for sure.
Wow. Literally interesting things that come up for me when you say that. One of the things I'm curious about is why you think so many people misinterpret a calling. Like, why do we end up in jobs we hate, things we can't stand doing, things we're not good at? Like, how is it that we miss what it might be?
I think we might be desensitized to the life experiences that would, I think, designate that would sort of show that. For me, and it's been hard. I mean, I've had times where, you know, I've been depressed and, like, not sure of, like, my place. And it took me a long time to kind of get my sea legs and sort of find the confidence to go out and stand up for the work that I've been creating or the work that I wish to create, or just to even be in the room with folks that came from a different background, that, you know, a different household with, you know, different history and whatnot. It took a bit, like, it definitely took a while for me. But the one thing that I was always thankful for was that, like, I never really doubted the fact that I wanted to make art and creativity was my language. And again, I wouldn't know who I was even growing up through high school. Like, you know, I went to, I was in sort of in junior high school in down South Florida, in Miami, but then I went to high school in Central Florida, I went to high school with just a wide range of kids that were affluent from sort of like rich backgrounds to, like, you know, kids from I grew up in like a mixed neighborhood with like, you know, little hood, you know, little hood rat stuff running around. I was getting into trouble, but like, I was always the artist. I got caught for doing graffiti, and then like, you know, the calligraphy led into me doing tagging and like writing, you know, graph in the streets. And then like, but I was always like really good in art class, and I was in fortunate to be placed in this gifted program at the time, to where I was smart enough to kind of get away with doing okay in school when I attended. But like, art was always my thing, and I think the people, my friends around me, kind of looked at to me for that, and that was like part of my identity, and it's just always stayed that way. So I'm fortunate that that has always been there for me. With other friends that I've had, and let's say, you know, everybody has those high school friends that are kind of, that they struggle to kind of find that. I think a lot of those things, again, comes down to, it's a confidence, it's a desensitization, that's a hard word to say, being desensitized to these instances in our life that can actually guide and lead us to continuing that path and trajectory to following our calling. I think those things happen for many personal reasons, but overall, I think we're taught to value very specific sort of demarcating factors of what success is, and those are varied. And I think, you know, James Victoria had mentioned this idea of like, you know, people valuing the car, the house, and the fat wallet. And people, I think, work backwards from that rather than working from something fresh and from something honest and sort of humble. You know, Mike Del Ponte had mentioned, you know, having meditation is something to where that he would start and sort of really try and go into a deep dive of like, okay, what's core and what's sort of valuable to my own experience? Like what is the thing that resonates with me most, and how do we tap into that? And that's where one finds a calling. Like he was mentioning, you know, writing down, and even in his own spiritual faith, which I have my own faiths and my own beliefs and my own spirituality. It's something for me very private, but it's always been something that's been a part of my work and a part of my family. And, you know, we pray and we have our own sort of sense of communion and whatnot. But if you can sort of at least allow for a quiet to sort of sit in and think really about what you want to do, not just like what you want to have, I think that's when you can kind of tap into it. And I think we live in a society, for me, I would say the ubiquity of media, the ubiquity of content, the access to just the, again, the imagery of the portrayal of persons' lives, these things that everybody seeks to be aspirational, it's confusing. And I think people, they just see that and they're like, I want that, without really understanding why they want it, nor how they can go about getting it.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I've been listening to Simon Sinek's book, Leaders Eat Last, and I've listened to it over and over again. And one of the more interesting parts of it is where he talks about dopamine and how they've done studies where people who use Facebook extendedly actually tend to become depressed because their perception of their life in comparison to everything they've seen makes their life seem worse than it actually is. And I think that that is one of the most insidious things about this sort of world that we live in, where everybody has a personal brand and everybody is able to do all these things. And of course, everybody's up to something far more epic than you are, which I've said 1,000 times. And, you know, but when we look at it from just a pure biological and evolutionary standpoint, it's actually quite disturbing.
Yeah.
I could, like, when I looked at what that did to people's brains and how, you know, my daily login to Facebook, like every time somebody clicks like, is just a dopamine hit. Yeah. And it's incredibly addictive, but it actually provides no lasting value, made me really start to examine the value of the relationships in my life. And I began to wonder, I'm like, wow, am I giving more time to my virtual relationships than I am to the real ones?
It's insane. Not only with sort of professional life and endeavors, but even with sort of with emotional relationships with significant others. It's this idea that, you know, I was reading that the first big revolution in in sort of matrimony and sort of been in courtship that happened sort of in the Renaissance or in during agrarian culture when we moved from being nomads on the plains, sort of hunters and gatherers, to having a stationary city-state or town with which you would have a communion of people at access, in proximity, rather than just sort of a tribal group that you existed within. You had a wider selection. The next great revolution has been the advent of the internet, where we're connecting people virtually. And beyond that, we're now sort of seeing them and experiencing them virtually, and we're seeing everybody's highlight reel. Mm-hmm. We're seeing everybody's good side. And it is something that's very disorienting. And I honestly, like, right before this, I'm probably on Facebook, like, posting something, a Throwback Thursday. I'm about to do a Throwback Thursday. And, like, it's just like it's hard to divorce oneself, because we can, I think, somebody like yourself, I mean, it's part of your job. I think it's part of your, I would say, acumen in relating to people, and for you having conversations with folks out there doing wonderfully interesting things. And it's a tool. And mm-hmm. I think one has to be careful with what one does with those tools. But it does have a detriment, and there are scientific studies for sure. And I don't really know or sort of pretend to have the answers, but I do know that, like, it's something that I think affects a great number of folks adversely. And it's interesting because we're in the middle of it. We're in the midst of it. We're in the midst of, I think, you know, social media and its sort of advent and pervasiveness. You know, it's something that is reaching a certain percentage of the world, but, you know, I forget what the studies say in terms of how many people are yet to be really connected to the internet. What happens when, like, you know, 80% of the world is connected, mm-hmm. and then we all start living our lives through avatars and online? Like, not to be, like, sort of futurist here, but, like, what does that do to then people's desires and their wants and needs and hopes? You know, how does that sort of change and shift things? I honestly think, like, for my generation, you know, seeing kind of being at the outset of that, like MySpace and stuff, uh-huh. You know, it was for me at the time, like, a place to post animated GIFs and, like, whatever. And then now it becomes with, like, Snapchat and, you know, Periscope and, like, all this other stuff. It becomes, you know, again, a tool to maybe broadcast your life. And then hopefully, you know, as for me, somebody that's kind of a public figure and an artist, to kind of broadcast what I'm up to. Mm-hmm. But it's a dangerous thing because, again, what is that detracting from the rest of your life? Like, you know, how is this sort of taking away from the moments that one could be experiencing? For me, living in New York City, like, the original social media platform, you know, it's New York. You know, yeah. Like, I live in Chelsea. I can walk outside and, like, somebody's got a story. I'm two blocks away from the Chelsea Hotel, you know, where, like, Burroughs was at, and, you know, Sid killed Nancy or whatever. Like, this place has history, and, you know, and I'm probably inside, like, messing around on Tumblr looking for memes, like Pepe memes and cat memes, and, you know, instead of, like, walking outside. It's for sure. It's an interesting thing.
So one of the things we've talked about a little bit is sort of the risk involved in pursuing a calling or a path that is creative. Do you think that this capacity for risk, to be able to handle the uncertainties and the nonlinearity of such a path, is something that is inherently built into certain people? Or do you think that it can be cultivated and learned?
I would like to think the latter.
I love where this is going already.
You know, like, but I think, again, we live in this, in a culture, especially, I would say, in America, where sort of a person's median experience can be relatively pleasant. It's not to say that there aren't persons without hardships here in America, but it's certainly, when you look at, you know, countries in sub-Saharan Africa, or, you know, parts of mainland China even, or certainly South and Latin America, Central America. I mean, it's rough out there, you know. And here again, this sort of cultural of kind of exceptionalism, where everybody it can be the latest and greatest and the best, and like the next Kanye, and like the next, you know, whoever. I don't know. It's a dangerous thing. It's hard to kind of see, but I think certain people, with the advent of their background, hopefully upbringing, hopefully their stability at home, even, or even their own sort of, you know, stick-to-itiveness, like their own sort of gumption for corny, cheesy word, like those people are gonna make it. And, you know, I think there's others that take a little bit more coaxing and maybe a little bit more like polish, in terms of maybe they need to go through like the linear path of, like, you know, having that education as a badge that they can wear on their sleeve to kind of hold their head up high and have that confidence to kind of tackle the day and be in those rooms. I think it comes down to confidence a lot. And then I think at the end of the day too, there's some folks that won't do that, and they don't need to do that. And not everybody needs to be a Richard Branson, like, or else everybody would just be in outer space already. Or, like, you know, it's not to say that anybody's life is less, you know, of lesser value because they are, you know, a single mother working 50 hours a week to put food on the table. Like, that life is no less meaningful than, you know, somebody with like 300,000 followers posting, like, you know, selfies in the bathroom all day. You know, it's like that, you know, those lives aren't to be valued, I think, by metrics and like social media. So it's like, I think, again, it's our value system that's that question. And I think even in the artist realm, you know, I think I'm a little myopic in the way I look at things, because it's always through the lens of kind of like visual context and communication that I kind of see things. I'm very interested kind of socially at how they roll out and how they affect the kind of larger psyche, and how the larger psyche kind of affects me and my own process and thoughts. But, like, I think, you know, I think not everybody can be successful. I'm not sure they should be. I think everybody should be happy and pursue happiness and hopefully find fulfillment. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, like, they each need to, you know, be on the cover of Time magazine or whatnot.
There's more of my conversation with Lex after this short message from our sponsors. Have you heard of Schoolhouse? Schoolhouse is a New York-based and globally inspired brand design agency. When subjective experiences challenge you as an individual, dare you to take creative risks and ask individuals to define the collective versus the collective defining the individual, life and experience serve as your schoolhouse. This is why Schoolhouse is about finding your brand truth and not just your brand story. At Schoolhouse, it's not only what they do, it's how they do it that makes the biggest impact. Authenticity, collaboration, and expression keep Schoolhouse sharp, excited, and honest about the work they do. They know the value of client relationships based on quality and trust. They're Schoolhouse, the branding brand, and you can learn more about them by following them on Instagram at SchoolhouseNYC or by visiting their website at weareschoolhouse.com. Now, back to my conversation with Lex.
So in your own work, what have been sort of the big sort of letdowns and failure and sort of moments when things have fallen apart, like the rock bottom moments, and what have you learned from them, and how have they impacted, you know, your work and everything that you're up to?
Good question. The main thing for me, which was a turning point in my career, which at this point, in looking in hindsight to something that happened just under 4 years ago, about 3.5 years ago, I had been running a creative agency here in New York City, which was something that I had just kind of gotten out of, starting as an intern, as I'd gotten out of Pratt. You know, I did a couple internships, a couple jobs. You know, I went to school for fashion and communication design. When I went to art school, I had started in Florida, apprenticing with two really wonderful painters, a Syrian-born woman painter, figurative painter, Rima Jabour and another sort of classically trained, like abstract expressionist artist, Jackie Otto Miller. Like I swept the floor, stretched the canvases, you know, cleaned the brushes in order to get taught. And then that was like what kind of built my portfolio that got me into Pratt and all the other art schools. And but Pratt gave me the scholarships that I needed to go. That was the only way I could really go to school there. But my parents, they were like, "Hijo, like, you know, if you're going to do this, you got to choose something that you can get a job at." So they wanted me to do architecture. I didn't really have interest in that. And I was like, well, I dig fashion. And then I'm like good on the computer because I'm a nerd. So I was like, I'll do design, whatever that is. And, but coming out of school there, I interned for a great design agency, Graphic Havoc, for a bit. And then I went into this other place, which I'll leave off the record. And then ended up working up my way with this guy and became business partners in this venture. And then that all went terribly wrong 4 to 5 years later. This person proved to be like just it was a classic like crazy business partner thing. Like police are involved, threats are made. I don't know when somebody's who's much older with more money and like better legal resources like is attacking me, and I'm trying to figure out like what am I going to do with life. I'm just trying to get out of this with you know the skin on my back basically. It's something that I'm still dealing with to this day, but it's something that at the time I couldn't imagine that somebody could be that evil after having worked alongside somebody for that long. And it really kind of hardened me in my outlook on people in general, just because I always say in most interviews that I do, like, I'm only here and I've only been able to achieve what I've achieved by, you know, via the strength of the people around me and the people that have believed in me and given me an opportunity. And, you know, I learned a lot from that experience, and I'm still learning from it. And it's still something that has repercussions for me today. But that, I think that failure to spot that, I think, that sort of danger or sort of malicious intent in somebody, like it's something that gives me pause now when I go into working with somebody at this point. I think it's a tough lesson to learn, and it's a very sort of New York lesson. Hmm. Like, you know, you put your all into something, you put your eggs in one basket, you know, you roll the dice and put all your money on black or whatever, and you never know. And when somebody's trying to short you, not pay you, like pull the wool over your eyes, and then threaten you and all this stuff, like it's a hard thing to believe at first, and then even harder to kind of deal with logistically. And that had been really tough. So that was a tough lesson to kind of to practically learn. And you know, proverbially, as they say, as one door closes, the other one opens. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the case with this. Like as I left, this person was somebody that was really great at burning bridges. And it was, you know, the design and fashion industry, especially in New York, is a very small one. So it was, I had learned basically that, you know, this was somebody that had really become kind of despised within that. And so that had actually been hindering me from a lot of opportunities, because people were like, well, you know, Lex, we love you and everything that you're doing creatively to kind of define this, but like can't work with you because like this guy's crazy. So I was able to kind of get out of that, and then sort of opportunities really just came to me. And the people that I had forged relationships with over the years through this business, like they really believed in me and were like, you know, we want to help you out, like let's work on this or let's work on that. But man, it was devastating on so many levels. Like it was a feeling that you get that sort of wrench in your stomach. What's the guy's name from Arrested Development, Michael Cera's character? Like there's a gif of him just like laying down on the floor face first on the carpet. Mm-hmm. And just giving up. Like it was that feeling, just like giving up on everything and just be like, what's the next move? And then an email comes in, and then it's like, Kanye West emailing me in all capital letters is like, yo, it's Kanye West. I love your work. Let's do some stuff. And then it's like, all right, cool. Let's go work on some stuff with projects with him and other opportunities with like other major corporations and brands. And that really kind of helped me get back on my feet in many regards, and keep it moving. And that's, you know, I think it's always about keeping it moving and having faith in yourself. And if somebody does attack you and somebody does sort of, you know, try to really come at you to destroy you professionally, even personally, as in this case, you know, maintain your composure or look to those. I mean, for me, I look to my parents. They couldn't help me financially or legally or anything, but at least they were there to like console me and like give a type of wisdom and advice that I think one's family can only give or those really near and dear to you can only give. But you know, that's definitely for me kind of the biggest kind of dark spot in the last years. And again, just trying to keep it moving and keep that faith and just look towards what's ahead and not what is sort of behind. Hmm.
Why is it you think that some people grow in moments like that and others don't?
I go back to the people around you.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really know anybody that had been through something like this. And if they did, it hadn't been to sort of the egregious nature of what had happened to me. But again, at times you don't need somebody to tell you step one, do this, step two, do this, step three, do this. If they're just giving you this energy and a warmth and consoling you in a way that is encouraging, I think that alone can sort of lend one the strength to try to figure it out, you know? And I think for me, much of what I do is problem solving. Mm-hmm. You know, art in many ways is a process of decision making. And for me, like I every day it's about problem solving. And I think I that's just something that I've learned, and it's the only reason I'm here, because I think it takes that to be able to work at a certain level. As much as one would like to say, well, with artists, I think everybody's practice is different. I think there are some artists that just kind of create out of this wellspring of like candy, sugar canes, and like hallucinogenics or whatever. Like, I am very much like, I know what I want to make. It's all in my head and it keeps me up at night. And I try to figure out how to manifest those things. And a lot of that stuff is like logistical and pragmatic and again, problem solving. For a lot of folks, I think it becomes a matter of confidence. It becomes a matter of sort of self-doubt, maybe a lack of support. And it's not easy. I mean, and it's definitely not easy in New York. I mean, it's not easy anywhere, but you know, New York is a tough city. It's not cheap here. The weather changes on a dime, and it takes a tough breed to kind of be here and flourish. And as cheesy as the maxim is, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah,
I think it means a lot. It means not only if you can make stuff happen professionally, it also means if you can deal with all the hustlers and, you know, tricks and thieves out there that are there preying on everybody here with a dream. Hmm. It's a very real thing.
You know, it's interesting. As I'm listening to you say that, I can't help but think of something that has happened for us recently. You know, there's this idea, I think, that we have in our heads that when we reach a certain level of success, that there won't be any more problems. And, you know, the more that we've grown as an organization and the bigger projects that we have taken on, the more I'm realizing how untrue that is. The nature of the problems changes, but they're always going to be there.
Right.
Which I'm blown away by that. And I think that going through what you have, I think is really, you know, people say, how do you develop the capacity to handle these high stress situations? I think it's by going through them. Yep. I really do. I don't think there's any sort of, you know, mindset or, you know, self-improvement mind fuck that you can do to yourself
right.
That will allow you to navigate these situations.
Yeah.
it honestly comes from experiencing them firsthand.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And well, as the great Puffy says, more money, more problems. Yeah, I mean, 100%. I think in part, you know, my MO has been with work, bite off more than you can chew, uh-huh, always. Also, I think there's a naivete in the way I sort of go after things, where I sometimes don't know what I'm getting into. I was offered just a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, to direct my first short film for the BBC and Channel 4 in the UK. And I had never so much as shot a movie on an iPhone. I knew nothing about film. My favorite movies are Step Brothers with John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell and Tron and all the Lord of the Rings. And so I'm not a movie buff. I don't know French New Wave or whatever stuff. But I got into it. It was the hardest experience in my life. Mm-hmm. And I made it through a year later. Took a year to make 7 minutes of film. Mm-hmm. But then we won a bunch of awards, Vimeo Staff Pick. I learned so much from it. And now it's a part of my practice. With the stuff with my ex-business partner, I didn't know how to do it. All I knew is I had, or how to get through it. All I knew is I had to get through it. And it was either my parents were we don't want you there in that city. It's not safe. This guy's threatening you. It could be it could get really bad. It's not worth your life, your well being. And they're you should move back. And I'm I can't do that. I had other stuff going on. I'm not going to let one person chase me out of this city within which I have people that I love, a relationship at the time, and breaking that up. And it was just a matter of having to go through it. And, mm-hmm, that comes with, I guess, time and age and experience. And, those problems don't go away. Success doesn't sort of negate those things. It, if anything, amplifies them. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing it can provide, hopefully, is the means with which to deal with them.
Right.
For me, now looking back, I look at the team that I have around me that I'm really fortunate to have, people working with me on business development and public relations and communicating the projects that I'm doing now, fashion collections that I'm launching in Tokyo and exhibitions that I'm planning for Art Basel in Miami in a few months, which I'm stressed about. But I have faith that it'll happen, and at least something will happen. Uh-huh. And it's because I've been through the other stuff, and then I've at least seen that, or I've done enough to where I'm just fortunate again for the people that are around me that have believed in me enough to give me an opportunity. And I've just really done my best not to mess them up. And a lot of times, my mom, I was just talking to her, and she's like, I was telling her, I'm so lucky that I never really know what's – I have sort of a roadmap for the next, 6 months or so of projects that I know that are coming out. But then it's – you never know when you wake up what email you're going to get and who's reaching out. And I'm fortunate that a lot of people that I worked with, they'll come back to me. And she's like, that's that's the best thing. When you – it shows that, you put trust in somebody, they trust you, and – that experience is worthwhile enough for them to come back to you. And that's what it is. I mean, for me, I try to be that type of person. I love being around people. Being an artist can very much be a solitary pursuit. And I get energy and inspiration from being around folks. And, I think with you and what you do and the conversations of people that you have, that you're in with, those are sources of inspirations for, thousands upon thousands of people beyond that, So it's great to share that, because I think in these sorts of conversations, which long form, I think they are had too far and too few and far between, these sorts of conversations, there's great value to be extracted from them. And, I lament and social media a bunch. I mean, it certainly has its place, and I can't sort of poo-poo the fact that it is sort of reshaping the landscape of art and the art industry. But, you know, I say that I work much better in IRL than URL. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, for me, really, again, just the things that I've been able to accomplish and achieve have come from, you know, the proximity that New York has afforded me, the friends that I've been able to make around the world. And that has come from just like going out there and meeting folks and like putting a smile on and like just try to be genuine and listen to people, like ask questions, like, you know, that goes such a long way. I think that's of great value.
Man, you're just packing this with lots of nuggets. One of the things that you had mentioned earlier that I want to actually talk about and do a deep dive into for the rest of our conversation is this notion of a creative identity. And I'm really curious how people start to find what theirs is.
That's great. I think it's tough. I think for some, and I just recently had an experience with someone that, like, I think a creative identity becomes something that is created. It is not fabricated, but it is something that's calculated. And I think there are, you know, just as Mike had mentioned in his about friends that would keep, that were looking to start businesses, they would keep journals with ideas of like, okay, a business idea a day. They are looking at who VC firms are funding. They're looking at what areas of research are sort of trending and what's of like topic online or like, you know, what's sort of on the tongues of people speaking at the next big conference. And I think also creatively speaking, I think there are those that do the same things, those that sort of are amazing curators of imagery on Pinterest, of, you know, Tumblr feeds and Instagram timelines. And they are able to kind of look at those things and see like, hey, what works? Like, what imagery is getting the most likes? What color palette is the most striking now? Like, where can I put my art for the most visibility? And they can form, like create a formula and speak to that and do it to a level that I think resonates. And then from there, build an identity. And that's fine. And I think that's a lauded skill. I think that's something that it has its place. You know, I think I've been looking at this really amazing article that the gentleman's came out in The Atlantic just like 6 months ago. The name of the article is "The Death of the Artist and the Birth of the Creative Entrepreneur." It's a piece that's written by William Dariuswicz.
Mm-hmm.
Great article, and it talks about this idea of where we exist now, where the idea of an artist itself has changed. And I think that's where I think people find, well, I think there are artists out there, myself included, that might take issue with Instagram artists and folks that are building a business off of a trope, off of, let's say, you know, a step and repeat applique of like, hey, I'm an artist and I draw squiggly lines, or like, hey, I'm an artist and I do colorful shapes.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm an artist and I do, you know, like nude pics or whatever. Like, they find that, they repeat it ad nauseum. They create a very monotone and balanced sort of feed to where if somebody, a viewer comes over and visits, and like within three flicks of the thumb, they can sort of get an idea of what that is. You know, I feel like they can understand and easily digest what that palette is or what the intent of that artist might be, if there even is an intent. I mean, art doesn't have to have any intention to it, but that's the situation in which we live. But this article talks about, you know, the definition of artist has changed, where the idea for us of what an artist is and one's identity is we still think to a concept that originated sort of in the Renaissance, where, you know, pre-Renaissance, the artists were craftspersons. The root word for art is to join or to make. And you know, before there was a Michelangelo or Da Vinci or Lombardi, whomever, like, artists were craftspersons. They were artisans. They were, you know, highly trained, skilled workers. But then there became sort of the idea of artists as celebrity. And I think that's after Dali and Picasso and Kahlo and Warhol and all these folks, you know, this idea of artist as guru, as sort of like lone poetic voice of a generation or whatever, like, and as celebrity, that's very much shaped the pursuit of what it is to be creative. I think a lot of times, and very much so now, there are folks going after celebrity using art. And I wouldn't say art, not my definition of it, but like, I think using creativity in a way to craft an entrepreneurial business and at the same time gain notoriety and celebrity. So I think that there are sort of different avenues with which people can kind of pursue what the idea of a creative identity is. I mean, I think for somebody like myself, I again go back to that it's a calling. And I remember my teacher, Rima Jabor, she was Syrian born, had emigrated to this country. She asked me what I was going to do when I was leaving to go to school. And she's like, you should do fine art. And I'm like, I want to, like, my parents don't want to let me do that. Like, you know, it's just too risky or whatever. And she's like, you'll know, because if you want to do art, there's nothing else you can do. You have no choice but to do that. And it's true. Like, I mean, I've always done it and maintained it as part of my practice. I've made a living balancing both. And for me, I'm actually inspired to strike the balance between sort of these amazing commercial opportunities for me to design my own collections or my own shoes or my own interiors and home goods and, you know, creating imagery for the CFDA awards and collaborating with, you know, Kenzo and other fashion brands and music artists. I am super inspired by the breadth of opportunity that I'm offered and the challenges that I'm able to tackle, like whether I know what I'm doing or not. It's like the work kind of speaks for itself afterwards. But it all came from a very sort of innocent and, I don't know, like a almost just like a naive place. And so my identity is, again, one that I can't even divorce from my own sense of self, where I think for others, their identity comes from maybe they can portray something. It could be like a Lady Gaga who, whatever she is, like, you know, it's a performance thing as much as it is an art thing. And you know, there's dialogue for both, but I think for everybody there's a different avenue and a different way to reach that. And I don't know if I can say who's right or who's wrong. I don't think there is that question. I just think that the definitions of how we are looking at these things are changing, and they're changing rapidly because of how technology as an overlay is affecting it, how people are consuming creative content in creative cultures, how brands are becoming the modern day patron saints of the arts, how, you know, basically there's very little academic and sort of national infrastructure that supports artists. It's hard for, there's another quote that, you know, art is for the inherently wealthy or the eternally destitute. There's been very little middle ground between artists and their professional careers. And, you know, it's hard for an artist to make a living, and it's hard for an artist to make like a middle class like living. It's either like you're willing to be broke as hell out in Bushwick living in like some dusty loft with like eight other artists for, you know, to sacrifice for the work, or you're, you know, somebody that comes from a wealthy background and is just able to go at it no matter what, or you're somebody in the middle that's kind of working professionally with alongside of brands, and that's completely viable in sort of the new sort of sort of a new trajectory and a new plan for the way that art is existing in our time. But it's definitely, I feel all in all, we're at sort of a very sort of apex sort of change for what art is, how we relate with it, and furthermore, how the people that are creating it exist and how they communicate all that stuff.
Man, that was amazing. So I have two last questions for you.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned getting to work with sort of iconic artists like Kanye West. And the question that raises for me is, what have you learned about mastery and performing at such a high level by being exposed to an artist like Kanye?
That's a good and difficult question. I think he's an example. Another friend is somebody I've known since I was a teenager. I was like 16. My guy Diplo is another producer who's amazing, and I designed his first album cover, Florida. Like, I've done artwork with them for years. We met Decent. He's somebody I'm still friends with to this day and work with. I mean, that's music. I think that's an example. I think I wish I had better, more diverse examples kind of in art or architecture or in technology. But in terms of mastery, I think it's a little bit about luck. I think it's about an intuition at times. I think, you know, it's about, I think, being in tune and confident enough or whimsical enough to kind of deal with and roll with the punches of an industry that's inherently difficult in regards to music. But mastery, it's a difficult thing. It's something that takes years and years of work and a whole bunch of hustle to get to that point. You know, I mean, with Kanye, I mean, he would always, I give him the credit of whether those persons are able to kind of exist outside of his shadow. He'd always bring a really great team around him. And there was definitely a lot of cooks in the kitchen that sometimes spoiled the broth, like, to quote that the internet video. But, like, famously that quote is, you know, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah.
You know, I give credit to that. I think, you know, these guys are persons that value at least having these people around them and understand, maybe even more so than I had at the time, you know, building relationships with, like, other people and being magnetic enough to attract them and hold their attention and, I guess, gain their trust and faith. I think celebrity and that stuff lends a lot to it. And I think it's a very sort of exponential growth to, like, when you build that within music. I think, you know, certainly once you achieve a certain level of visibility, it's like, oh, let's go. Mm-hmm. I think in other industries, it's much, much harder because there's, you know, I still maintain that, like, well, in art, it's a very private experience. Like, I think music is something very communal. It's something that's shared in an environment that is conducive to people meeting other people. It's a concert. It's a club. It's a memory that's made. It's something that's shared amongst many people. Where, you know, if you go to a gallery exhibit or you see an image online, this is something that's typically like sort of processed by oneself. And it's, you know, you think to, if you were to ask like your average teen now, like, you know, who are like the biggest like music artists out? And then you ask them like, who are the biggest like contemporary artists, visual artists out? It's like, you're going to get completely different answers. You know, I think people can't really relate. Just visual art, I think, resonates at a different level. I think it resonates at a sort of slower wavelength and a slower frequency than music does. Mm-hmm. So the idea of like kind of mastering those things are much different. You know, for me, I always say that like I'm in this for the long run. You know, this is something that like I again don't know how to live without it or be without it. And for me, I don't know if there is a definition of mastery for what I wish to do. I think I only wish to be able to, I think, manifest all the ideas that I have in my head before I have to leave this planet. You know, I think there's a wealth of things that I would love to do. And I just hope to be kind of afforded the opportunity to do those things and to share those things. but that's not guaranteed, and I know that. And I only try to work, get up and work and push and do the best that I can so that I can hopefully make that stuff happen and make a decent life out here.
Wow. Well, this has been awesome. So I have one last question, which is how we finish every interview.
Thank you, Sri. I appreciate it.
At the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Them being themselves. I think once you tune into whoever you are, and I think if you are unafraid to be the person that you feel you are without sort of the pretension of fitting into an idea of a norm or to placating somebody's sort of imposed trajectory for you, or I don't know. When you're willing to kind of expose yourself, be yourself, and stand up and kind of be an individual when it doesn't feel right to be an individual, you know, when it doesn't feel right to fit in, you know, to when you feel like you don't fit in the room, and you're okay with that, and you have trust and faith in who you are and where you come from and the people behind you. I think that's what makes somebody unmistakable, because you can't deny that. I think regardless of where that puts you in the world, like you gotta recognize that. And I think that's something that I always find that I appreciate in folks, is that when they're genuine, when they're humble, when they're not sort of but besides themselves, regardless of their accomplishments and achievements, and that's rare. And I you know, somebody again like Mike DelPonte, I value his friendship greatly, because you know he's somebody I feel that has that, and it's great to resonate with those kinds of folks, because the energy is always there, the vibes are always good, and that's few and far between. And so you find those people, you hold on to them, and you try and grow together. But definitely, I think that makes somebody unmistakable.
Well, this has been incredible. Really, one of my favorite conversations. I mean, you just packed it with so many inspiring stories and nuggets, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story. No,
absolutely, my pleasure. It's an honor. I can't even begin to tell you the folks that you've talked to. I'm just honestly honored and honestly totally nervous to have done this, but I thank you again for taking the time to talk, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.